If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello and welcome to BBC History Magazine's weekly podcast. I'm Dave Musgrove, the editor of the magazine, and this is the second of our December 2011 editions. Don't forget, BBC History Magazine is on sale in all good newsagents and on subscription. Our website is historyextra.com, and you can follow us on twitter.com/historyextra and facebook.com/historyextra. Coming up this week, we have...
The book is an experiment, and when I started it, I had no idea if it was really going to work.
That was Peter England, author of a new book on the First World War.
He believes that the complexity of the world could only be explained by an intelligent designer.
And that was Professor Michael Hunter on the 17th century scientist Robert Boyle. Our first interview this week is with Peter England, a Swedish historian and author who is also permanent secretary of the organisation that awards the Nobel Prize for Literature. Peter's book, The Beauty and the Sorry, has just been translated into English. It tells the history of the First World War through the stories of 20 different people who experienced that conflict. Our deputy editor, Rob Attar, caught up with Peter on a recent trip to the UK to find out more.
I'm interested in the title of your book. What would you say was the inspiration behind that?
The Beauty and the Sorrow. It's in Swedish, it's more complex, and it's a beauty and the sorrow of struggle. And it's sort of trying to capture something that is very apparent in if you read many of the memoirs and the journals and the diaries and the letters that come out at the time, that many people, mind you, not all, but many people, especially in the beginning, are very, very attracted to the war. And they really want to participate in it. And beauty and the sorrow, the beauty stands for all these elements that makes men, and not just men, people, both women and men, want to participate and do so gladly. So it's the beauty is all these. It's not just beauty in a aesthetical sense,
right.
But because there is a sort of aesthetical side to war. But it's beauty in a. It stands for all these factors that makes men want to join in enthusiastically.
And you've taken the approach for your book is very different from most history books because you've taken the individual stories of a group of people who weren't necessarily the most important people.
No. Quite the contrary. I've chosen infraordinary people.
Mm. And so what made you decide to use that approach for your book?
Well, the book is an experiment in history writing. I wanted to see if we do it the other way around, that we don't build a history book on great and important event, we don't build it in the usual manner with a grand narrative, and also in the usual manner use individuals as just examples. What if we sort of turn the tables and try, if we only take the individuals, only take the individual experiences, interlace them with each other, will we still get something of a picture of the event that they participate in? So the book is an experiment. And when I started it, I had no idea if it was really going to work. So it was an experiment in several ways. It could have been a complete sort of, with me ending up all that work and throwing it in the dustbin. That was one of the options. I did not know if the experiment would give.
And do you think this approach gives you a different insight into the period that you don't get from conventional history?
Well, yes and no. I think it's also so simple that you can do this approach. And I want to stress this. I'm not trying to say that this is the way to do it. I think this is the way to do it when you have already a pretty stable picture of the events in established and good history books. I think this book could only be written because there are a number of great history books on the Great War written in a sort of traditional manner. This is not an alternative way of writing history. It's a complementary way of writing. It tries to complement the many of the other books that are great books that have been written through the years. So it's not an alternative. It's a complementary version.
And from all the tens, hundreds of millions of people who were affected by the war, how did you choose the ones that you featured in the book?
Well, I chose them from the angle that the book was going to, even though it was only 20 people, and 20 people, I can never say that, you know, they are representative or something. It was some 63 million people in uniform and something like that. They can never be representatives of anything but themselves. But I chose them from one simple criteria, and that the book was going to show the multiplicity of war. I'm not just saying, okay, let's not just have the Western Front, but also the Eastern Front and the Balkans and Italy and Mesopotamia and Africa and so on. That multiplicity, but also the multiplicity that comes out of not just having military men, but also civilian. Not having, of course, not only men, but also women, and not always people in their early 20s. Most of them are in the early 20s, of course, because that was the generation that were in their prime and were called up. So, and also not just people who were enthusiastic, but also people who were very skeptical about it. My own small work I've been doing as a war correspondent myself has taught me, not that much, but has taught me that people react very, very differently in these types of situations. Some people really grow and enjoy it even. Other people, they loathe it from the beginning. They sort of get ground down into the... They get crushed by it, and they never recover. Some people bloom in it even. So the reactions of individuals are very, very different. And that was also something I wanted to have, to show how different people react to these type of events. And also, and that was another point, when you use people as examples in a grand narrative, you use them, okay, here I want to have someone who is enthusiastic. Well, then I take her and I plunk her down in my grand narrative. But the interesting thing that if you follow people along, you will see that they're often a sort of development. They are changing themselves. So people can go from being quite enthusiastic and eventually wind up being part of the revolution, as there is a German sailor here in the book, who starts out as a very, very strong nationalist and pro-war, and eventually takes part in the revolution that stops the war and ousts the Kaiser and so on. And just using people as examples tend to belittle them. Right. So I wanted to have their full story as far as possible in the book.
Because often in I guess, more conventional history books, you won't have someone changing their opinion halfway through. They'll be used for certain points.
They are used for points, and they are used for points. And that is a problem as I see it. One of the things that I tried to do in this book was to take each of these individuals sort of seriously, trying to, by limiting the view from what they could possibly know on these single days that's the backbone of the narrative, also makes them more understandable. I think when we are looking upon the Great War, especially when it comes to, say, the outbreak of the war, much of it, of their reactions, are so foreign to us. They all seem so strange. I know I've been teaching First World War history, and my students have often reacted, they must have been mad, they must have been, you know, as they were silly or something. Yeah. But they weren't mad, and they weren't, they were quite as intelligent as we are. So it's trying to rescue them from the sort of the unbelief that comes over us when we see such an event as the First World War.
Trying to get inside their minds and see how they work.
Yes, and in a sort of honest way, taking them seriously. None of the people in the book were fools in any way. Some of the people reacted in ways that I really probably can understand closely how I myself would react, or you would react. Others have reactions that are quite alien. We have this English winner of the Victoria Cross, and who is a really gung-ho type and so on. But still, trying to take them seriously, treat them as real people, and not just as examples to be used.
And so how did you research their stories?
Well, it was, as I said, the tricky bit was not finding material, but finding people that would sort of fit into the bill of, as I said, multiplicity. I wanted to have different experience, different attitude, different types of people, different countries, different fronts, and so on. And it was also a matter of looking at the available material and saying, how good is it? How close can you get to this person? So it was also a choice, and there are always choices involved when you write history, about having good source material. For instance, one person that you can only find in the English-speaking version of the book is Sarah McNaughton, a Scotswoman. And I jumped at her at once because she has written a book on her experiences, her early war experiences, that was actually published during the war. But now there is also available her diary and some of her letters. And there is a... they don't really match totally. So you can see sort of where she... This is the official version, and then you have the private version. And sometimes they match, but sometimes they don't. This was impossible, of course, with many of them. You can't use several versions. For instance, you have a Dane, who was enrolled in the German army. I could see a bit of the same mechanism. I, of course, wanted to have source material, both that was sort of the official version, and also try to find their own versions of it, and see, because there are always differences.
There's a lot about psychology, really, in the book, and
yes,
about you learn a lot about the way people perceive the world and the way they represent their views in different ways.
Yes, there is. I think some of it is so sort of common enough garden variety. Psychology, trying to understand people, but trying, as I said, trying to understand them from within, as far as that is possible, because we have the limitations of the source material, of course.
And do you feel that you've learned a lot about the Great War from writing this book?
Well, I've been writing about shorter things about the Great War before this book, and I've also been teaching I'm a historian. When I was at Uppsala University, I've been teaching it, so I'm pretty familiar with it, and I'm pretty familiar with the topic. Well, of course, a lot of the Schultz. For instance, drugs during the First World War. The use of cocaine and what we now call recreational drugs. The use of drugs was quite widespread. Also, sex, when you can get to it. And I was, of course, I must use that. When I found in one of the Italian soldier, when he actually mentions masturbation. Of course, it's a phenomenon that must be enormously common, and no one ever talks about it, but he mentions it. And it's about venereal diseases, prostitution, and all these things that have been sort of put away. And they are hard to get hold of, but finding them and seeing these, how people talked. They didn't say at the front, they say at the front, as it was one word and so on. The changes in clothing, the changes in food, in lighting, all these things that, if you have the big picture of the war, and there are great books about that, these tiny details tend to slip away, but the details of everyday life and seen from these 20 people, they were, they gave me a sort of a new understanding, and new images in my head, how it looked. So.
And if, I know you can't do that, but if you could have met any of these people, is there anyone in particular you'd like to have met?
Well, several of them, as I said, and I think that there's probably a sort of deviation in the book. As I choose these people, I found several of them interesting in their contradictions. And all of them are, in some sense, contradictory. They are pulled by different impulses. This woman, Sarah McNaughton, who actually died as a result of the war, she got very sick when she was in Georgia, and died here in London in 1916. She was obviously a very, very bright woman. I think there were things that we could impossibly see eye to eye to, but I would like to have discussed it because she had a very keen sense of her own limitations, of things that she didn't approve of, things that really confused her. And she was really tormented during her last year in life by this. The same is this Dane, who I don't really know exactly what happened to him. He was missing in action in August on the Somme. He, by all accounts, he was dead, and I think I found the place where he was buried. But he was also having this contradiction in himself. The contradictory part of it is interesting. He is attracted to war, but he is not a volunteer. He doesn't really want to go, and he wanted to end as quickly as possible. Please, can't it end? And he grabs on all rumors that, well, it will end in a couple of months, and it will end in August or something. So he's these people who are pulled in two directions at the same time. I feel very sympathetic to that sort of reaction. So any of them would have been very interesting to me. I would love to have met any of them. I know I have met relatives to some of them, and this far the reactions have been positive.
For the people you've met, the relatives,
No, I've heard of it. I met only one, and that is a relative to a person that you can only find in the Russian edition of this book, who was in the Imperial Army. And I met a relative, and she never met him. It was a granddaughter or something, but she said that the family has approved, and I will possibly get the material from his wife as well. I can expand it in some ways. No, anyone, I would have loved to met any one of them, but Sarah McNaughton and Christian Andreasen, the Dane in the German army, they have these, they are struggling with themselves, trying to accommodate in this very strange situation, and I can really find that interesting.
That was Peter Englund. The Beauty and the Sorrow has recently been published by Profile Books. Now it's time for our historical trivia moment. Last week we told you about tall men in Prussia. This week it's smuggling. In 1762 in Falmouth, a two-week-long bazaar of Oriental goods took place, with the luxury products on sale just arrived in the holds of three East India Company vessels from China. And everything, of course, was sold duty-free in an extraordinarily bold display of smuggled products. So that's quite a few weeks of fascinating historical facts that we've imparted to you, and yet we've received none in return. So if anyone would like to email in with further interesting historical facts, we'll gladly read them out here, if they're true, of course, and give you a name check. Email us podcast@historyextra.com with your facts. Next, Professor Michael Hunter's recent biography of Robert Boyle, the 17th century scientist, has just won the Samuel Pepys Award. This presented a good opportunity to find out more about Boyle from the man best placed to tell us more, so I caught up with Professor Hunter to talk Boyle. We're talking about Robert Boyle. He lived from 1627 to 1691. He was one of the key figures of the scientific revolution of the 17th century. Can you give us an idea of what his key contributions were? What are the main things that we should remember him for?
I think most important is that Boyle effectively invented the modern experimental method. It was Boyle, more than anyone, who thought that it was important to carry out controlled experiments, to record the findings in great detail, if necessary to repeat them, to record failed experiments when experiments failed, and so on, so that you built up a kind of body of data, of experimental data about the workings of the natural world, which could be used as a basis for conclusions to be drawn. So I think that more than anything, he is a great experimenter, and that is his chief claim to fame. But he wasn't a kind of aimless experimenter, because he did have an agenda, which was to prove that the world worked according to mechanical principles rather than according to the more sort of qualitative principles of previous theories like those of Aristotle, which were still really the predominant way of understanding the natural world up until Boyle's time. And so he really wanted to use his experimental findings to prove that the world could best be understood according to mechanical principles rather than by any other means. And so some of the experiments on which he laid most greatest stress were ones which he believed did actually vindicate a mechanical view of nature, particularly an experiment that he did in the 1650s on nitre, saltpeter, where he was able to, as it were, take the component parts of a chemical composition apart and then recombine them. And he believed that that showed that that was as close as you could get to a proof of the chemical structure of matter.
Okay, so where did he get the idea for experiments from? Was he working, you know, completely on his own here, or was he building off a corpus of knowledge of people trying experiments before him?
There were traditions of experiments, particularly in chemistry. In practical chemistry, people had been doing experiments because they were trying to produce substances which they could sell or use as medications, etc. But in terms of a kind of theoretical background, the person to whom he owes most is the English natural philosopher Francis Bacon, who had laid out a kind of program for investigating nature empirically and inductively through his writings, and had begun to do a bit of such work, but had never developed it in the systematic way that Boyle did. So I think more than anyone, Bacon is his inspiration. As far as the mechanical philosophy is concerned, he's the heir to the pioneers of putting forward mechanical explanations, such as René Descartes and Pierre Gassendi in France. So he's not a pioneer of putting forward mechanical explanations, but I think he does take the mechanical philosophy to a new level by offering this empirical vindication of it, which hadn't been there before. So I never really finished the question of why he was important.
Oh.
In a sense, because you see, I think that's his chief claim to fame as a scientist, but I think that he is also quite a significant writer on the theory of science, on sort of scientific epistemology, thinking through what types of information, what types of proof are reliable, what kinds of information we can trust. And a lot of this relates to his views on the relationship between God and nature, or science and religion, because he is constantly placing our knowledge about the natural world in the context of our knowledge of God and his plans and his design for the universe. But as I say, in the course of expounding his ideas on these sorts of areas, I think he came up with more sophisticated ideas about the nature of our knowledge about the natural world than many of his contemporaries.
And the title of your book, Boyle Between God and Science, I suppose, alludes to that debate he was having with himself about that. So did he find it difficult to reconcile religion and science, or is that moving it too far from what he was thinking about?
I deliberately chose the word between because that doesn't have any sense of conflict, which many people have read into it. But Boyle, I think, believes there is no conflict whatsoever between God and science. But he himself, as it were, is a sort of a figure who elucidates both by his investigations of the natural world. So Boyle is literally between because that is where he's conscious that he's located. I don't think he has any sense that the study of the natural world could ever threaten a belief in God. In fact, on the contrary, he believed that if you properly understood the natural world, it could only lead you to a belief in God. He believes that alternative, non-theistic views of nature are implausible because he believes that the complexity of the world could only be explained by an intelligent designer, and he believes that the more you know about it, the more you will be convinced of that. So Boyle, contrary to modern presumptions, Boyle, and like many of his contemporaries, has no sense of a conflict between science and religion. He's aware of a threat to Christianity, and he is aware that threat may be based on an imperfect, sort of ignorant view of the natural world. But he believes that by educating people in their understanding of nature, they will be led towards an appreciation of God. I mean, it makes it sound as if I'm a sort of apologist myself, but I'm not. I'm just doing justice to Boyle's own views, because I think he is absolutely convinced that there is a complete harmony between a proper understanding of the natural world and a belief in God.
And how widely shared were those views amongst his fellow do we call them scientists at this point, or do we call them natural philosophers? What's the term that we should use?
I personally use the terms as synonyms, because we know what we're talking about. I mean, it's true that people who studied nature in the 17th century are not identical with scientists in the 20th century, but I think they're sufficiently close for us to know what we mean. And it's often, people have often used the term natural philosopher so that they can't be accused of being anachronistic, but in fact, I think it's better just to sort of say at the outset, obviously, there are differences between those who studied nature in the 17th century and those who studied it in the 21st. And that's to be taken into account when I use a modern term like scientist, and yet I think we're fairly clear that we know what we mean. So after that preliminary, it's actually very difficult to find people who had a hands-on approach to nature like Boyle who aren't quite fairly religious. There aren't people out there who are who are actively involved in the study of nature who are aggressively anti-Christian. There, of course, are thinkers who are, one of whom did have some interest in understanding the natural world, and this is Thomas Hobbes. And I think Hobbes, more than anyone, exemplifies the anxieties that people felt about how attitudes to the world in general and to man's place in it could lead in an atheistic direction, although I think Hobbes himself would have claimed that he was not an atheist, and I don't think there's any reason to believe that he was. But people could see that Hobbes's view of the world, which is a mechanical, a completely mechanical view, a sort of material, a completely materialistic view, and his view of how man fits into that, is moving in a direction in which you have a plausible view of the world and man's place in it, from which God could be removed. I mean, Hobbes doesn't remove him himself. He believes in a corporeal God. But many could see that it was a fairly short step in a Hobbesian universe to dispensing with God altogether and believing in a universe that worked just by on its own, and human institutions which worked according to purely human sanctions. So that's where the threat is coming from. And so that's why Boyle was keen to disagree with Hobbes's explanations of many of the natural phenomena that Boyle brought to light through his experiments. He had a spat with Hobbes in the early 1660s. Concerning his findings about the nature of the air. And then there was a further, he published a further attack on Hobbes a decade later in the early 1670s. And I think he's quite explicit that the reason for this is because he knows that that Hobbes's ideas are influential and he thinks they're pernicious to religion, and that's why he is anxious to show that Hobbes's supposed explanations of natural phenomena aren't very convincing either. So I think it's Hobbes and the impact of thinkers like Hobbes that is where the threat is coming from. So, but ironically, it's not coming from in a sense, science is lined up on the orthodox side in this debate. And of course, after Boyle's death, he founded in his will a series of lectures, the Boyle lectures, which were intended to defend Christianity against irreligious threats, and various lecturers, including Richard Bentley, who later became Master of Trinity College, Cambridge, and Samuel Clarke, who was a theologian of the period, and others, used this as a platform to put forward a theistic view of things against the threat that they saw from Hobbes's followers and those whom they called atheists.
Okay, so that's covered one of the possible contradictions in Boyle's life. The other one that comes through from your book is the question of alchemy. He's very interested in alchemy, which seems to be a bit of an issue in terms of seeing him as a man on the cusp of modern science, doesn't it? Or am I overstating that case?
I think alchemy is a difficult issue. I mean, there's a sense in which alchemy is part of the sort of hands-on experimental tradition that Boyle was indebted to in forming the modern experimental method in science. So alchemists were among those from whom he learned in a practical way. But he also clearly believed that the elite of alchemists had insights into the structure of matter and the structure of the universe, which he would like to find out. And at this point, we do seem to sort of slide into an area where he is getting involved in essentially magical ideas rather than mechanistic ones. And he himself is actually rather uncomfortable about this, as I've shown in my work on Boyle and alchemy. Boyle is worried that insofar as alchemy may contain secrets about the universe, which you find out almost by gaining a kind of insight that not everyone can have, that is only available to a kind of elite of people with special knowledge, that there could be something slightly dangerous about this, because it might be a kind of temptation from the devil rather than a gift given you by God. So here we come. This is where we do come to aspects of Boyle's religious life which aren't quite sort of serene and straightforward as the sort of view of the harmony of science and religion might make it seem, because I think he did have a quite troubled spiritual life. I think he believes that God is quite, you know, God is a demanding master to work for, and that believers are constantly being placed under temptation by the devil, and that, you know, part of the way in which you show your spiritual worth and your moral fibre is by resisting these temptations. And it does seem, from an interview he had with a bishop who he consulted about such matters, that he was worried that the alchemical inquiries that he was engaged in might be leading him in a dangerous direction as far as his spiritual life was concerned. Quite how much this affected how far he went down that route, of course, is hard to judge, because we only have these hints of his doubts, and he does seem to have indulged in quite a lot of alchemy. But there, you know, it is clearly a slightly complicated picture, but more for moral reasons than straightforward epistemological ones. I mean, I think he believed that the world was a very complex place. Even if the world could be explained mechanically, you had to have a very sophisticated and subtle version of the mechanical philosophy, which could include insights that derive from alchemy to make sense of natural phenomena. So in that sense, he thought that alchemy could be a useful part of a knowledge of nature. But insofar as he then draws back, it's because of the sort of moral dangers of being involved in areas of knowledge which were illicit rather than untrue. And there are undoubted complications there.
Okay. He lived in interesting times, didn't he? Both scientifically, with all the happenings that were going on in the 17th century, the foundation of the Royal Society in 1660, but also politically with the Civil War, the Restoration, and the 1688 revolution. He would have seen all those. Did those latter events pass him by? Was he too engaged with his philosophy and his writings to take much interest in them, or did he actually get involved in those underlying political events?
He's actually he is a rather apolitical figure. Many of his contemporaries were much more directly involved in these events than he was. Boyle tends to stay on the sidelines in these great events. In the aftermath of the Civil War, he seems to have been really surprisingly uninterested in the events going on around him. I mean, obviously, he suffered some inconvenience from some of the post-revolutionary circumstances in which he found himself, in terms just of having to sort of avoid people affiliated with either side when you were travelling, and you know, because you might actually get sort of held up and have all your possessions taken from you and that sort of thing if you were in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I think also taxation and things like that are problematic to him, but he really seems surprisingly uninterested in that. And insofar as people have tried to place sort of strong political affiliations on Boyle, it doesn't work. I mean, they slip off, because that's not the sort of person he was. He seems to have been really surprisingly uninterested in these events, and most of the effects that they had on him, as I say, were these sort of incidental side effects rather than a case of direct involvement on his part. So in the interregnum, he actually avoids direct affiliation with the regime, say, of Cromwell. I mean, but on the other hand, he equally isn't because he was at Oxford in the 1650s, and we have some interesting reminiscences of him at this time, which I think are revealing from this point of view. And on the one hand, he avoided close affiliation with the supporters of Cromwell, who were running the university at that point. But equally, he avoided close association with the sort of diehard Anglicans who were holding secret meetings and things like that. He deliberately seems to have sort of kept an intermediate position. And then after the Restoration, he's very happy to go along with the status quo and be associated with the regime. And in fact, that is the point at which he comes closest to having some sort of political role, because he's involved in certain government initiatives for colonial affairs and things like that. But he doesn't seem to enjoy it much. He finds politics too sort of, there's too much infighting and selfishness for him. And so he really withdraws from that fairly quickly, because after all, he effectively had a life's work in the investigation of the natural world to which he was by that time devoted. And so much the same state of affairs continues thereafter, that he has really very little contact with politics all through the Restoration period. But we don't know his views on the Catholicising regime of James II, but one presumes that he probably disapproved, because he does seem to have been quite keen on the Glorious Revolution in 1688. But it's all fairly peripheral to his main life and thought, and you have to work quite hard to find out the hints that I've just collected together in that commentary I've just given you.
Okay. Where do we find his sort of early influences? Why did he become the experimenter, the natural philosopher that he was? Because he went to Eton, didn't he? And he went on a grand tour. So he seems to be doing all the sort of things that you might expect of a young gentleman at the time. Was there anything that particularly marked him out as someone who'd be ploughing a different path?
That's an interesting question on which I have quite strong views. I think so. Just working through, I mean, he came from a very privileged background. His father was the so-called Great Earl of Cork, one of the most successful adventurers in Elizabethan and Jacobean Ireland, and he made a lot of money out of the redistribution of land for which he was responsible in the late Elizabethan and Jacobean period, and became very rich indeed. So Boyle and all of his other his brothers and sisters got a very good endowment from his father. So Boyle was effectively a sort of millionaire by inheritance, and was able to just do what he liked. And I think actually that it was quite a powerful influence on him, although of course there's no reason why he need have done anything worthwhile at all. You know, he basically had an income for life and was brought up in very opulent circumstances, and that could just have led him to the life of a waster, sort of hunting, shooting and fishing, like many of his contemporaries. At Eton, I think he was quite my reading is that at Eton he was quite a difficult boy, and there wasn't much sign of great things to come. Then he goes on the he went on the grand tour, and he wrote an autobiography which covers much of that those travels, as well as his childhood, and he reports a conversion experience at that time. But that initially he returned to England just in the aftermath of the Civil War, and started writing treatises not on science at all, but on moral improvement, trying to instill superior moral principles in his aristocratic peers, there are really a large body of writings, and also there are devotional writings and things like that. He thought he might be a religious writer as well. My theory is that he had another conversion experience. You know, he had this religious conversion in Switzerland, he says, in his autobiography. But I believe that at about the time he wrote the autobiography, shortly after that, he had a conversion experience effectively to science. And the kind of books that he writes changes almost overnight. And it's not, well, the reasons for it are, I mean, it's easier to describe this sudden change than to account for it. What happens is that, having written these really rather turgid religious and moral tracts, and also some slightly livelier quasi-religious writings inspired by the romance form that he had come across during his continental travels, but all of these also are just putting across moral messages in a slightly more inventive way in literary terms, but you know, the message is the same. But suddenly he discovers the study of nature and builds a laboratory and starts doing experiments, and starts to become fascinated by the understanding nature in detail, and becomes fascinated by the new philosophies that are around, but not partly of the chemists, partly of the mechanical philosophers like Descartes, and partly authors like Bacon. And it seems as if the reason for this is that he, at that point, became acutely aware of the dangers of the threat of irreligion. This is slightly before Hobbes, because Hobbes had had predecessors who had seemed to threaten Christianity, such as Italian thinkers from the 16th century like Machiavelli and Pietro Pomponazzi, who people suspected of sort of damaging the Christianity in the way that Hobbes did on a larger scale in Boyle's time. So the initial awareness of this threat precedes Hobbes, but it's rather similar to the threat that he perceived from Hobbes later. And in a sense, the arrival of Hobbes in the 1650s, I mean, the arrival of Hobbes's ideas, as represented particularly by his book Leviathan of 1651, all of this, as it were, reinforced Boyle's anxiety about the threat to Christianity, which he believed that the study of nature was the best defense against. And so it does seem to be in 1649 that he had literally had this sort of conversion experience from moralizing in a sort of more general philosophical way to the study of nature, and it does seem to be because of this awareness of a threat to Christianity which he thought that science could protect against, that his whole sort of purpose in life changed at that particular moment. And this can be documented from his extensive surviving archive.
Okay, last question, just to wrap things up. So you've written this award-winning biography of him. You've edited most of his works. Therefore, you know a lot more about him than me. So what's the obvious question that I should have asked you? Is there something that we've missed out here that I should have been pressing you on?
My encounter with Boyle started by cataloguing his archive. There's a huge Boyle archive that has been at the Royal Society of London since the late 18th century, which had never been catalogued. And so in the 1980s, I catalogued that, and really everything grew from that. And I also found some extraordinary personal documents which revealed the extent to which Boyle had a kind of tortured spiritual life, which is partly reflected in his attitude to alchemy and magic, but is also reflected in a more general concern about the sort of extent to which he is serving God in the way that he should. He also clearly suffered quite severe religious doubts and things like that. So he has a difficult religious life. And in fact, in one of the papers that I wrote when I first started writing about Boyle, and of course this also is all recapitulated in the biography, I think that in the same way that he in his spiritual life he examined his conscience and was constantly sort of probing and trying to make sure that he got the right answer on moral issues, I think that his experimental policy could possibly be seen as a kind of extension of that from his inner psyche to the natural world. In fact, there's one comment that he made in an interview with a Bishop Burnett, who took down some notes for a biography of him, in which he said that he made conscience of great exactness in experiments, which seems to me to, in a sense, to sort of prove the causal link between his spiritual life and his activity in studying the natural world. So I think I would like to think that it was discovering this sort of this sort of complex tortured Boyle that has been my contribution to Boyle's studies, and in a sense I think in many ways it's made him a more interesting and perhaps believable person in a 21st century context than the rather serene lay saint who dominated views of Boyle ever since the 18th century, when the previous edition of Boyle had come out. So that is, as I say, is what I would see as my significant contribution. And then, but that needed to be put in the broader context of trying to understand him as a whole. You know, I published a volume of collecting together a series of essays I'd written on Boyle in 2000 called Robert Boyle's Scrupulosity in Science. And in a sense, that is my sort of, that's my reinterpretation of Boyle. But the biography then takes that and puts it in the context of his contribution to science and to the understanding of the natural world and his role in the life of his day, which, although he has no political role, he is quite active as a philanthropist, as an encourager of missionary work in the American colonies and in the Far East and things like that. So he does have quite a public role outside science in terms of being a kind of pious and public-spirited layman. So all of that is there in the biography, and I'm hoping that it all fits together to give a convincing view of him as a whole. So I think that probably more or less covers everything that that I feel that I've achieved on Boyle over the last. I mean, it was really a sort of quarter of a century I was working with Boyle. I've now faced life after Boyle more or less, although I'm still writing the odd paper because people still want me to contribute to conferences and things.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does, or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest, whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Michael Hunter is Emeritus Professor of History at Birk Beck College, London. His biography, Boyle Between God and Science, is published now by Yale University Press. If you're interested in some of those political and religious debates that Boyle didn't get overly involved in, our current issue includes a feature on Puritan attitudes to Christmas in the Civil War. And if you want to know more about Thomas Hobbes, I interviewed Professor Justin Champion about him in our 22 July 2011 podcast, which you can download still for free. That's all for this week's podcast. Please join us next time when we'll be talking about the role of religion in war and female voters in the 1930s. BBC History Magazine's weekly podcast is recorded in Bristol and produced by the entertaining Dave Gibson. Thank you for listening.